Welcome to Canadians Baseball This Week, your one-stop shop for everything baseball here on the home of the Canadians, Sportsnet 650. Here's your host, Rob Fay.
On a Sunday morning, maybe you're driving around, maybe we got you online somewhere around the world. I am Rob Fain. This is Vancouver Canadians This Week, episode 11, right here on the home for everything Canadians, that of course being Sportsnet 650. And if you're a baseball fan, if you're jonesing for the game right now, trust me, you are not alone. But more than anything, over the next 60 minutes, we have crafted a show for you that I think you're going to really enjoy listening start to finish. For example, we're going to go into the time machine in a couple of different ways. In segment two of this show, we're going to have both Ernie Witt, former Toronto Blue Jays catcher, and we will also be joined by Larry Walker. Now, those interviews took place back in 2013. I want to see how well those dated, because again, got to remember, Larry Walker was a long way from Cooperstown when we had that conversation, and Ernie Witt talking about the state of the game of baseball, I want to see nearly a decade later how much that conversation could advance, or if there was a lot that he said back in 2013 that holds true to this conversation. So again, segment two, we're going to get deep into both of those conversations with some baseball greats. And then, in segment three, probably at about 11:35, 11:40 this morning, probably at about 10:35, 10:40 this morning, I am going to give you some play-by-play from what I consider to be the greatest single inning in Vancouver Canadiens baseball history. I have broadcast more than 1,000 games. There's a lot of innings in this big old jar head of mine, but one inning stands above them all, and I will have that for you because I just want you to feel baseball right now. I mean, for all of us, we're sitting around wondering if these labor negotiations are going to get done, if baseball is going to find their way back on the field with fans, without fans, whatever, but it just needs to happen. A little sprinkling of baseball for you before the top of the hour. All right, let's get to it because baseball's labor negotiations right now almost feel like these are the conversations and the volleys that should have happened a year from now. Of course, everybody knows that that big black cloud in the future is essentially the CBA. The one part of baseball's future that it seems like everything hinges on. And if you do the math, it almost feels like some of that has seeped a year forward into the conversations that Major League Baseball and the Players Association are having right now. Major League Baseball sends the Players Association and President Tony Clark their first volley, and it is returned with a no, but here's what we think you could do. To which Major League Baseball's owner said no. So now you have had one offer go each way, neither of them budging, and there are some key points here. Listen, I took a pretty significant haircut when it came to my salary, and full disclosure, I work for the Vancouver Canadiens, and they asked me if I would take a reduction in pay. I was happy to do it, because I know right now there are trying times. But I also understand that when your organization has no money, you just have no money. So I'm going to try to explain this to you from both sides of the fence, because here's what the owners are thinking. They're wondering why they're getting lambasted in the media right now and in the court of public opinion, because they're billionaires, right? Let's remember something. A billionaire is a billionaire in assets. It's not that he has $1 billion in cold hard cash just sitting at home waiting for a rainy day. Before you jump all over the owners and say that these are billionaires and this should be a no-brainer and they should be paying this, that, and the other, let's remember something. There is no doubt that if the owners could get this game back on the field, they would. So now I'm going to look at it from the players' perspective, because I also believe in their side of the argument, which is, listen, I've got an agreement with you. I'm putting my body on the line. I'm putting my health and well-being on the line, and I want to be compensated for making sure that we can push this game forward. As an owner, you've got an agreement in place. You need to honor it. The problem is, and this is after sifting through a couple of things, it feels like it's a bit of a floating offer that Major League Baseball's owners deciding as COVID happens and as their reality changes, that they are going to take their newfound reality and put it in the player's lap and say, hey man, I need a solid, I need you to help me out. That in today's day and age isn't going to work. And the reason that it's not going to work, and this is again where I might side with the players. If I was to broadcast baseball, and I was lucky enough to do a good job, I can do this job till I'm 75 or 80 years old. I mean, Bob Robertson, broadcaster for the Spokane Indians, has been at this for 55 years. But a Major League Baseball player, their window, if they're a good player, is a decade. If you're going to put your body in a situation physically where there is potential you could catch COVID, I understand it. I know what you're thinking. Well, these are going to be controlled environments. They're going to get tested all the time. That's true in theory. But the reality is, a baseball player with the limited shelf life that they have cannot take any risks. you have to make sure that every T is crossed, that every I is dotted. And for some reason right now, it seems like Major League Baseball's owners are looking for a few elbows to the side, a few IOUs, and let's just get through this together. As a player, as a union representative, I can understand why they want to hold firm on this. Really, this is, in my estimation, the stalemate. The number of games and at what compensation level they're going to be at. You got to remember things here. There's insurance. There is how are they going to be handled with travel? How are they going to be compensated being away from their family? What percentage of that compensation is out there? So many things that I almost wonder if baseball shouldn't just scrap it for 2020, if they shouldn't push forward their CBA and try to get this done so that when COVID finally falls by the wayside and we can go back to the stadiums in droves, not just trickle-ins, that we might be able to just get on with things. It feels like 2020 is a lost season, doesn't it? Like, am I wrong to say that 2020 almost feels obsolete? Like, sure, you're going to get some games in. And yes, baseball will get their revenue from their television agreements. You look at certain players that have decided that they're going to go get Tommy John. You look around at all these different opportunities where players are like, you know what, I could take this year off. I can get myself right. I can get myself healthy, and we can get back on. And then the last caveat to all of this, certain baseball players don't feel all that comfortable. Now, they won't say it that publicly. There have been a couple that have gone on social media and said that maybe this is not the right time to be publicly negotiating with everything that happened to George Floyd south of the border. I know that the George Floyd tragedy is something that has gripped more than just the United States, but it almost seems ill-timed, doesn't it? For baseball right now to be going back and forth with everything that's going on, not just with COVID-19, but everything that is going on in our society. You know, the Vancouver Canadiens came out with a statement the other day, and it had to do with everything that's going on south of the border and making sure that you knew that we were striving for equality and becoming a better organization, even though I think the Canadiens do a really good job when it comes to equality for all. I mean, between the events that they do for Pride, and there was just no discrimination at this ballpark. I've been very proud to be with this organization as a whole. But I will tell you this, kind of a personal story, that in my years with the Vancouver Canadiens, I have come across racism, not personally, but I have been a firsthand accountant of watching it happen in real time. And we went to a ballpark a couple of years ago, and it's why I have so much respect for Vancouver Canadiens manager Rick Mignante. Rick Mignante showed up, the bus pulled up, it was the 4th of July, and one of the organizations decided that they were going to try and set a record for the number of flags that they could put up to, you know, patriotism, make sure that everything was good. And so I think they got to like 250 or 300 flags, and all of a sudden, a couple of the players looked at the manager and said, you know, I'm a little uncomfortable here. And so Rick, a Californian, said, you know, what do you got? And they said, well, look at some of the flags out there. They've got the American flags, they've got the state flags, and then they've got a couple of Confederate flags. So Rick Mignante, right away, acknowledging that that was not acceptable. You got to remember, this is probably about 4 or 5 hours from game time. So the front office staff is all ready to go. Everything is set. The bells, the whistles. It's the 4th of July. There's 1,000 things to do. Rick Mignante goes up to the executive of this organization and says, we are not going onto the field tonight with your sellout crowd until you take every single one of those flags down. And it was funny because the organization that had put them up really didn't understand what all the kerfuffle was about. But the reality was, is that there were players that looked at that as a symbol of suppression. You got to remember, if you go back into the history books, there are many a symbol right now that would really offend many of us in different walks of life. So as I sit there, I say to myself, you know, I understand from 10,000 feet. But I was really proud that the Vancouver Canadiens, who got their hands dirty with their statement this week, said that we are all-inclusive, that we want to create an environment out at Nat Bailey Stadium that is a comfortable, safe environment for all. And I can assure you this, having traveled south of the border, there are challenges. I have seen them with my own eyes. I have gone out with the players after the game and seen things that I couldn't believe that I've seen. And again, as a PR guy for the Vancouver Canadiens, you're not supposed to bring these things to the forefront, but let's just talk turkey. There's definitely challenges in certain places that you go. But the one place I have not seen challenges is Nat Bailey Stadium. And maybe it's because I'm proud to be a Canadian. Maybe it's because I've seen it and I just don't see it here. I'm very happy to work for this organization. You don't get to work for a lot of jobs and for a lot of companies where you're proud of what they stand for. And what the Vancouver Canadiens had to do, a very delicate subject, was say, listen, Our players aren't here 12 months a year. We don't have spokespeople the way that certain other organizations do. Every year, it's kind of like the cup with the Yahtzee dice in it. You roll out five new dice and you see what you get. That's kind of how the Vancouver Canadiens are. But our front office, a combination of diversity and gender equality and things that I think are very standard in certain mindsets, but not in all mindsets. I think I just wanted to say that, listen, the Vancouver Canadiens hear what the community is saying right now. Changes are going to have to be made across the board, and the Canadiens are going to do everything that they can. And again, just speaking as a broadcaster, they're going to do everything that they can to make sure that when you come to Nat Bailey Stadium, you feel welcome, regardless of your race, your color, your creed, your sexual preference, whatever. And again, I'm not reading off a script. This is just real talk in real time. Very proud to work for the Vancouver Canadiens and loved the way that they approached a very tough and delicate time in our society right now. All right, we'll take our break here. When we come back, we got a lot to get to. I mentioned right at the onset of the show, we're going to go into the time machine, and that is what we're going to probably have to do more often than not this show, just because there's no baseball on the field right now. But that said, we got plenty of opportunity for you to talk baseball. On the other side of the break, we're going to go back to the time machine and talk a little with former Toronto Blue Jay catcher Ernie Witt. Yes, Ernie Witt, Bing Ernie. Remember when he was making those home run swings and all of a sudden he dropped to the knee? He had one of those swings. Nobody ever tries to emulate that swing. They always try to emulate Jesse Barfield or Pete Incaviglia or Julio Franco. But you know what? Ernie Witt had a very distinct swing. He's been a big part of Baseball Canada as well. We'll get into that. And also Larry Walker, Cooperstown's Larry Walker. These interviews with both Ernie Witt and Larry Walker are from 2013. I want to put the sniff test to them. You got to remember, Larry Walker was a couple of years away from finally getting into Cooperstown when we had this conversation. So I like seeing if some of these things rang true, if they held up, or if they went a completely different direction. And as well, in our final segment, I take you back to Nat Bailey Stadium, the year 2012. It was the greatest single inning in Vancouver Canadiens history, and I wouldn't trade those moments for anything. So you're going to get your baseball fill if you keep it locked right here on Vancouver Canadiens This Week, and you're listening to it on the home of everything Canadiens, Sportsnet 650.
To Canadiens Baseball This Week, here on the home of Canadiens Baseball. Here once again, your host, Rob Fay.
You know, as crazy as it sounds, even though there's no baseball right now, this particular show has been really engaging for me as a host, because for the first time in God knows how long, I've really had to go back into the vault and try to bring forward things. Oh, sure, I'll talk news of the day and what's hot, but it's been really cool, with no scores to report, to go back and think of conversations that I've had over the years as broadcaster with the Canadiens. And I went back nearly a decade to 2013 to find two of the most enjoyable interviews that I've had in a long, long time. The first one that I'm going to bring you, we've got Hall of Famer Larry Walker still to come, but the first one that I'm going to bring you is former Toronto Blue Jay catcher and Team Canada manager Ernie Witt. Now, Ernie stopped by Nat Bailey Stadium. He's doing an appearance just the one night, and all of a sudden, we got into a whole variety of things. I don't get starstruck very often, but there was something, as a kid that grew up in Toronto, all of a sudden to be face-to-face with Ernie Witt that I was nervous for the first 2 or 3 minutes. So here it is, an interview with Ernie Witt. We covered everything from platooning to what he thinks of Baseball Canada as we speak right now. I want you to listen to this interview and see how many of these things, these points that we get into, stand the test of time. Because analytically, platooning, there's a conversation for that. Baseball Canada didn't used to be able to get the big fish to come out to the big dance in the big World Baseball Classics. I want you to listen back to 2013, nearly 10 years ago. Here's Ernie Witt talking about the game as it stood back then.
You are the unanimous nice guy. Everybody says, oh, you're going to love Ernie. Ernie's a great guy.
Who said that?
I can't remember, actually. It's all the guys down in the clubhouse, Clayton McCullough and all those guys, Dave Pano. So talk to me about this. You come out here. I don't know how many appearances you do over the course of a year, maybe a handful. But what is it like when you come into a place where it's in a Blue Jays affiliate and they remember you? You're the guy with the big swing. You drop to the knee and you play.
Oh, you even remember that. That's amazing.
Do you remember the 10 home run game?
Of course I do. I hit 3 of them.
You did. No, I remember that game because I just thought to myself, I was a little kid at the time, and I was like, this is like the greatest thing ever. Yeah. Every game must be like this, but not the case.
Yeah, that goes back quite a few years. What was that, 87, I believe it was.
It was pretty, yeah, I was a teenager, young fella.
That record still stands
yes,
to this
it does.
Day. So, I mean, that's hard to do, to hit 10 home runs by one team
mm-hmm.
in a single game.
Can you talk about that night? I mean, what was it in the water? There was just something that just... Did you guys in the dugout look at each other and say, wow, we're onto something special?
No, there was nothing like that. To be quite honest, we just knew that it was a blowout. And for some reason, I was seeing the ball well at that time. And the pitcher, whenever he made the mistake, a lot of times you'll foul those pitches off. And at this point in time, that night, I didn't foul them off. I was able to find them, hit them over the fence.
Yeah, no kidding. So, that was something else.
Just one of those things.
You were a part of the Blue Jays in a great era. You were there for the first American League East pennant. Can you talk to me about the fact that that was a really big moment in Blue Jays history? You finally got over the hump.
Well, I think the fact that, you know, people ask me, what do you remember the most about the Blue Jays? And I do remember that year the best, because being a part of it since the inception in 77, you know, I saw the growing pains that we had gone through. We had players that were developing at the major league level, guys that should have been down playing in the minor leagues. They were learning the game at the big league level. And, of course, when you're going against all-star players, you know, you kind of get your stuff handed to you, you know. Yeah. And we did, but we kept getting better. And we had a feeling that once Bobby Cox took over as a manager, it was a totally different feel in the clubhouse. It was, you know, we're not going to try to lose 100 games this year. It's like we're going to win 80 games this year. You know, it's just... Just some little small words like that just changed the whole atmosphere of the team.
Yeah.
We saw the team coming together in 1984. That was the year the Tigers.
They were fantastic
that
year.
They got off to a tremendous start, 35-3 or something like that. But come August, we were still in the race with them. And we just didn't have a closer at that time, you know. And so Pat Gillick and Beeston, they went out and acquired Bill Cottle and Gary Lavelle, and they thought that that was going to be our closers. Little did they know that the closer that we got from Texas Rangers, Tom Hankey, was a man that put us over the hump. And we finally had a closer to close out games in 85. And, you know, it was a battle all the way through in that final series against the Yankees. Remember George Bell making that final catch and us winning it on that Saturday night. So then the following day, Phil Niekro got his 300th win in the major leagues.
How about that? You know, you are, for me, and I'm 39 now, and I remember sitting in the $4 cheap seats behind George Bell out in left field. And, you know, I think to myself, for me as a child, that era of Blue Jays baseball might remain still one of the best. I mean, the Blue Jays have been around 40 years. They've had some good teams, 92, 93. But I think for me, there was a little more pride in watching you guys go from the outhouse to the penthouse. And I mean, you guys played some pretty good teams. I mean, you guys got, what, Kansas City, which was a fantastic baseball team. Front end pitching, big bats, George Brett. They had a fantastic closer. I mean, but yet you guys competed. There was something in the clubhouse that kept things going.
We did compete. It was the chemistry on the team was outstanding. We all wanted to win. I guess that and we had each other's back. And you know, a lot of people say, well, chemistry doesn't mean a lot. Well, I say, bull crap. That means an awful lot. You know, you want teammates that are going to go out and do the job, do what they're asked to do, you know, hit behind a runner, put down a sacrifice bunt, whatever it takes to win. I mean, it's a team sport that's built with individual stats, but yet when you put a team together, those individual stats really doesn't mean that much, but yet you look at the end of the year, you win, and that's because you do all the little things that's necessary to win.
What is it like to platoon? I don't know if I see platooning the way that I saw it back when, for instance, you and Buck were together. What was that like? Was there a special relationship between you two? Was it competitive? How did that all come to be?
No, it was, naturally I wanted to catch all the time. Buck wanted to catch all the time. But then you look at it and you say, well, let's look at it on a positive way that by platooning, maybe I'm saving my knees a little bit more. Now maybe I have a longer career as a catcher. And so I tried to look at it that way. And there was constant communications between Buck and I. And because during the course of the game, you know, if they changed pitchers and we were losing, I was going to come into the game, or vice versa, Buck was going to come into the game. So, but we also talked about our pitching staff. You know, we talked about them an awful lot, what they were able to get over the plate at the time and what was working for them, what wasn't working for them. So that was a constant communication.
Who had the worst batting stance, Garth Orge or Jesse Barfield? I mean, those guys had two pretty unorthodox swings. Jesse, all you saw was his butt. And Garth, I don't even know how he came to be with that swing.
No, I would say Garth had the worst batting stance, but he, you know, it was effective for him.
Uh-huh.
You know, and And even now, working in the minor leagues with the Phillies that I'm doing now, you know, working with the catchers and working with hitters, I don't care how you do it, just as long as you get it done.
Yeah.
You know, as long as it works for you and you're accomplishing and you're, you know, you're getting better. So that stance worked for Garth. And
the way it goes, huh?
The way it goes. I mean, I wouldn't teach everyone to go on a back knee the way I hit the ball either, but it worked for me.
It did work for you. So let me switch to the Canadian National Baseball Program. Okay. You, of course, the manager of that program. This is it comes under scrutiny, the National Baseball Program, because there's flashes of brilliance, like the Pan Am Games, and, you know, we look around the major league levels, and it's littered with Canadians now. But then there's moments like the WBC. Where do you go when it comes to the glass half full, the glass half empty approach? Do you, as a manager, try to dissect it and say, boy, we got to get better at this? Or do you say, hey, we've already come so far in this regard?
My approach is Canada has tremendous ball players if they all play. But let me put it right there.
How do you extract them? How do you get them to play?
That's their choice.
Yeah.
I mean, they choose not to come and play. I mean, are you telling me I wouldn't want a Ryan Dempster as a starter on the mound?
Yeah.
You know? I mean, there's some guys that have injuries that, you know, they just can't do it. But if we brought all the players that are playing at the big league level, we can compete with any team. But when you don't, you know, we don't have the depth that some of the other countries have. Mm-hmm. So when you lose a player or he choose not to come and play, then that hurts us, because now we're going down a level where other teams, well, like, you know, I mean,
Dominican, you know, United States.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, they've got players that they can pull from. And they're just as good as players.
Do you feel an obligation to call these players? Like, have you ever called a Ryan Dempster or a Jeff Francis?
Well, we've talked to them all the time.
Yeah.
You know, and again, I've always been under the belief is I don't want to beg a player to come and play. That's their decision.
Yeah.
I want players that's going to be on the team that's all in. I mean, if there's any doubt in their mind that they don't want to be there, I don't want them on the team.
Yeah.
That's just the way I am.
Who came and approached you and said, hey, do you want to manage Canada's baseball program?
Kevin Brion, who is a scout with the Blue Jays. This goes back to 1999. He approached me and asked if I'd be interested in managing. And I said, well, yeah, I'd love to.
Uh-huh.
You know, and so that's how it started. And Kevin moved on and became a scout with the Jays, and Greg Hamilton took over, and Greg says he's wanted me every year. So after this past WBC, I said, you want me to resign? I said,
no.
You know, but I was being honest. I mean, we've got a lot of good qualified Canadian coaches now that could come and do the job. But Greg is happy, I guess, with where we're at and what we have come a long ways. And I enjoy doing it. I love doing it. I love to compete. And, working with the Canadian kids, they'll run through a brick wall for you.
Yeah, they will.
You know, and it's just my job is just to try to put them in, you know, areas where they're going to be successful.
Do you feel that perhaps you are a great bridge between the Blue Jays organization and Baseball Canada? Because let's face it, Baseball Canada needs that relationship. And I would assume from a PR perspective, the Blue Jays need to be kind of in bed, so to speak, with Baseball Canada. You seem to be the guy that's got both ears of both organizations.
I don't know whether I have the ears of the Blue Jay organization.
Do you not?
I don't think so.
You don't got any clout over there?
No. Remember, I got fired in 2008.
That's okay. Oh, they're bringing everybody back. I went to spring training. I couldn't believe who was out there.
Yeah, I know. Everyone's there. But I'm happy where I'm at. You know, since 2008, things have changed around a little bit over there. But, you know, the Blue Jays have been very supportive to Team Canada.
Yeah, they have.
And, you know, we take a lot of their players, too, not only in the WBC, but all the other tournaments that we go to. And they're very good with that, and they're very big supporters of it. So it would be difficult without the support of the Jays.
Yeah, he's not wrong, and that's Ernie Witt, by the way, from 2013, our first of two throwback interviews here. And, you know, you talk about the Toronto Blue Jays and the relationship with Baseball Canada. It's always kind of been there. I'd always like to see it go one more level, and, you know, I'm not 100% sure what that looks like. I don't know if it's necessarily financial, but it would be nice if Baseball Canada had a true home. And I have long said that I thought that Rogers Centre would be that home for Baseball Canada. Why not centralize everything? Because right now, what you get with Greg Hamilton and Baseball Canada, yes, you've got the emblem, and yes, you have a national baseball program, But if you were to poll the average Joe as to where Baseball Canada sets up shop, I don't think a lot of people could even answer that. So to me, if you want to give this organization more of a forward-facing front, I would like to see the Toronto Blue Jays go one level further, bring them in-house, and just really try to give that national program one more boost. Because it's not like the United States or Puerto Rico or Cuba or the Dominican Republic. Canada's got to fight for their identity on the world stage, and I do still believe that the Toronto Blue Jays could do even a little bit more than they have done. All right, let's switch gears. You know what? Ironically, these two interviews do have a little connectivity because Larry Walker, who's next up, he was also in Vancouver back in 2013 as a part of the Superstar Series that the Canadians put on. We talked a little bit about Canada's baseball program as well. You got to remember, he's still got his fingers in the red and white of Canada. So before we get to that, let's just talk a little bit about Larry Walker, who was still years away from getting inducted into Cooperstown. It didn't make it into this interview, although I think he was trending around somewhere around 20% at the time. There was definitely work to be done for Larry Walker. It's not long after he retired, and I picked up the conversation basically saying, do you miss the game?
Did you have that moment when it finally came to an end where you thought, wow, I wish I could do this forever?
Yeah, I was content with it, really. The first year was a little tough, I guess, but after that, I knew I couldn't do it. You know, I didn't feel I could play to the heights that I had myself put to, and if I couldn't play to meet those standards, and I wasn't going to bother.
What part of your game do you think you appreciated maybe more than fans? I mean, everybody called you the five-tool player, that one guy that had a little bit of everything. What did you take the most pride in when it came to your game?
Oh, boy. Probably base running and defense. You know, the hitting came kind of natural, but the base running I worked on hard. Defense worked on hard. A lot of instructional leagues to learn the position. You know, as a kid, I didn't play the outfield, so I really had to learn it in the minor leagues, and that was where all the work went into.
I also want to talk about Canada's national baseball program, because I was complimenting you this morning when I did the morning show that you've kept your hands in that program, and they need the Larry Walkers of the world to still be involved. We'll get to the eyes of Satan in a moment, but let's talk a little bit about that program right now. Where do you see it? Because to me, I see six of one, half a dozen of the other. Sometimes they'll go to the Pan Americans and they'll win a gold medal, and then they'll go to the WBC and they'll get shut out.
Well, you know what? It's a tough thing, especially the WBC. You're taking, you know, hopefully mostly major league ball players and sticking them. They got 2 or 3 days to work together to try and figure out how to do it. Your pitching is limited to how many pitches a starter could use, and pitching's our, you know, our weakness, where we don't have the depth as we do offensively and with position players. So it's a hard task to meet up to the standards of what the U.S. have, Cuba, Dominican, Puerto Rico, these guys that play year round and have thousands of players to choose from. Our pool is a smaller handful, and not quite as much talent as some of them. So, it's not fair in some eyes, but I think we're still, we're number 7 ranked team, I believe, in the world still. So we're still doing pretty darn good.
Do you look at that program and say, you know what, the guys that have had some success at the major league level, they need to do what you're doing and at least keep their hands in it, just so that the bloodline goes on through generations?
You know what, as a Canadian, I think all the Canadians will keep their hands in it in some way or shape or form, and I think that's just in our blood. You know, we're not going to let it go and just walk away. I don't stay into the game too much as far as with the professional. I'm being asked to do some things, but I don't want to get in that aspect. Just doing stuff for Team Canada is all I need right now.
Why? Why wouldn't you want to do a little more at the pro level?
Well, I still have an 11 and 13-year-old at home, so I don't want them to miss out on Dad. They've missed out enough on Dad already. So, and if you coach, you're even gone more than a player. So I'm happy staying with them.
Do they know who their dad is?
No, not necessarily.
Are you cool with that?
I'm perfect with that. That's the way I like it. They ask questions about it, and then, what do you mean you're going to the ballpark to throw out the first pitch? I go, you'll know one day. So I leave it at that.
Are they starting to get to the point now where they're starting to poke and prod? Because I mean, when they're younger, they're just happy that their dad's around. But are they starting to put two and two together?
Well, they know. You know, I come home with bobbleheads. You know, I just in Denver, and they had a bobblehead day for me in Colorado. So I threw out the first pitch there, and they sent me 250 bobbleheads, and the kids see all these and wonder what the heck they are. You know, they look at them and start laughing and bobble my head. Yeah. And now, you know, so they have a good time with it, but they don't really know. I don't need them to know all that stuff.
Do they figure it out? Are they in sports at all?
Soccer and gymnastics, yeah.
Soccer dad, huh?
Yeah.
Did you ever think you'd have that tag hanging over you?
I got three girls, so I guess I had no choice, right?
Absolutely. Hey, just before I let you go, I just want to really quickly refresh our listeners that are just joining us. You're here for tonight. what does it mean for you to come back to Vancouver specifically? I mean, you're a BC guy. You come out to Nat Bailey Stadium. This park's been here for 60 years. You get to come back and see it revitalized, rejuvenated. What does it mean to see that baseball's still thriving in your home community?
Well, I love it, you know, and the success that they've had here as an organization is good. I know years back that there was talk that the team would be leaving, but I know some people jumped in and saved the team. And what do you play, 38 home games, and this is the 15th sellout already. So yeah. I think for an A-ball, lower A-ball affiliate, that's outstanding. So you know, you applaud the people of Vancouver for coming out and supporting their team.
Well, that is very high praise from a guy that has seen many a baseball stadium in his day. All right, Ernie Witt and Larry Walker now in the rear view mirror, which means on the other side of the break, we're going to go do a little play-by-play. I'm going to take you in the time machine one more time, back to 2012. Vancouver Canadians were in a dogfight with the Boise Hawks for the Northwest League Championship. The boys were down by a whole bunch, but in one inning, were able to turn the entire series on its ear. They would go on to win their second straight championship, but I will never forget the bubble of the seventh inning in Game 1 of the championship that changed everything for the Canadians. You're listening to Vancouver Canadians This Week, and you're doing it on Sportsnet 650.
Welcome back to Canadians Baseball This Week, here on the home of Canadians Baseball. Here once again, your host, Rob Fay.
Final segment of Vancouver Canadians This Week. I'm Rob Fay, and let's get to it. You know, I've loved being able to reflect over the last couple of weeks about the last decade that the Vancouver Canadians have had with the Toronto Blue Jays. Hard to believe that this year would have marked the 10th anniversary between the Vancouver Canadians and the Toronto Blue Jays. It's been a partnership that has been too good to be true. All right, so let me take you back to Game 1 of the Northwest League Championship here in Vancouver. It was a best-of-three series, one in Vancouver, Games 2 and 3 in Boise. Boise was loaded. You're going to hear some names over the next 10-15 minutes that are littered with future Chicago Cubs. I mean, that year, they had everybody from Albert Amora, Dan Vogelbach. They had so many guys. And the Vancouver Canadians were just holding tight. They go into the bottom of the seventh at a sold-out Nat Bailey Stadium down by four. They had been punished by the Boise Hawks, but all of a sudden, lightning in a bottle. I have broadcast 1,044 games since taking the job for the Vancouver Canadians back in 2007. This is the greatest inning I have ever watched with these eyes.
Two outs in the bottom of the seventh. It'll be the all-star shortstop, Jorge Flores, with the runner at second against the first rounder of the Chicago Cubs. Yeah, they went out and had to get the big gun, and they probably made the right decision. Here comes Hayden Simpson, the hard-throwing right-hander out of Magnolia, Arkansas. Did his university at Southern Arkansas. Let's face it, he's the stud out of the bullpen right now, and he has got a little bit of time against the Canadians. My voice cracking. I didn't think we'd get to this moment in the baseball game. Back on July 13th, he actually picked up the loss. Went 3 2/3, scattered 6 hits, 3 runs. Only one of them were earned. And almost a month to the day, he picked up the win after going 5 innings, striking out 6, limiting the Canadians to just 3 runs on 5 hits. So he's not Superman, but in this moment, he's definitely an upgrade, as right now, the Boise Hawks bullpen is scratching their heads, saying, boy, we thought we had this team dead to rights. And yet Vancouver has fought all the way back. They're not within 5 or 4. They're not within 3 or 2. They brought it to 1. And Jorge Flores, he's going to get a raucous ovation as he steps into the box. Tucker Frawley, he's out there in the middle of the diamond. He represents the tying run. So can you believe it? But the C's, 180 feet away from tying this game at 7. Jorge awaits the first pitch. It's on its way. It's a curveball that misses, and the count goes to 1-0. Hayden Simpson is the guy. He's one of those guys that you draft and you say, you know what, we're going to give him a couple of years, and he'll be somebody. It'll pitch for us at Wrigley one day. But here tonight in Vancouver, He's got to get his team out of a pickle. Fastball up. And the count goes to 2-0. You've got DJ Davis on deck, and that would be interesting, a battle of first rounders. Simpson was taken five selections after DJ Davis, who's on deck with that black lacquered bat wearing the black number 12 jersey. But before we get to Davis, the stage is Flores, who right now is ahead of this count, two balls and no strikes. 7-6 Boise, but the Canadians with the tying run out at second base. 2-0 is inside.
Everybody clap your hands.
On a night where butterflies took center stage north of the 49th, the Seas have remedied that with five runs and are now looking to tie this game up. Lockham on four pitches. Tying run at second. Lead run on base at first. DJ Davis is 18 years old. He was signed by the Toronto Blue Jays for more money than you and I will make in a number of years. But here today, it doesn't matter how fat his wallet is, what round he was taken, it is simply him against that right-hander. Hayden Simpson walked the first person he faced. He has yet to throw a strike. Fastball low, five straight pitches have missed the zone. The roar of the crowd, the boos and the hisses can only mean one thing. It's a visit to the mound from Wilson Contreras. DJ Davis does not have a hit in the postseason. If he gets one now, it might physically rip the roof off this building. Swing and a miss, and the count goes to 1-1. Bullpen activity for the Canadians. Boise Hawks have something brewing as well down the first baseline as the chess match between Mark Johnson and Clayton McCullough continues. 1-1. Swing and a miss on a wickedly placed changeup, and Davis steps out of the left-handed batter's box knowing that the last swing so off the ball will probably summon that pitch again before this sequence is done. Canadians with runners at first and second. Down by one. They haven't come all the way back yet. This comeback means nothing if they can't come all the way. 1-2. Curveball missed. We'll do it at 2-2. First curveball that Simpson has thrown tonight. First time that he was in a scenario where it was something that he could offer up. It's going to be either a change up on the outside portion of the plate or a fastball up. Simpson comes set working from the stretch. Frawley will it a pounce. Change up out to the second baseman Amaya. Fielded cleanly. Flips it and it's dropped! Frawley can't score. He didn't see where the ball was. Amaya flips it to Hernandez and Hernandez dropped it. The most critical of errors at the worst possible time. And Kellen Sweeney steps up in the bottom of the seventh with the bases loaded. A gift to the second baseman of the Hawks. And just like in last night's game in Yakima, it's Amaya that has trouble with a baseball, throwing it into shallow left field and giving the Canadians another lease on life. Sweeney's single in the eighth inning in game one against Everett in the West Final was the only RBI in the entire game. Fastball missed low and the count goes to 1-0. Tying run for the Canadians is 90 feet away. Lead run is out at second. Big insurance run is over at first. One-oh. is a fastball that is in the dirt. You've got 4,000 fans right in your face, and Hayden Simpson's feeling it right now. Silence the fans for but a second. Three balls, one strike. Seized down by one, but this is it. This is the push.
So the Canadians clawing back to bring it to within one, and really, I would say the biggest single individual folklore hero in Vancouver Canadiens short season history is coming into the batter's box. I don't know what it was about Balbino Fuenmayor, not a major leaguer, a guy that fizzled out somewhere between AA and AAA, but for this 1 year in Vancouver in 2012, he could do no wrong. We talk about Marcus Stroman and all the guys that have come through town over the years, Noah Syndergaard. I would put Balbino Fuenmayor's popularity above all of them. He was a cult hero, and it was his moment right here that kept things going for the Canadiens.
One was earned and took the loss. The lights in my press box are flickering. The energy in this building is unbelievable. Rafael Taplan against Balbino Fuenmayor. First pitch was a curveball that is fouled off. And the count goes to 0-1. Balbino's got one hit this postseason. Canadians have the lead run. The lead run. 90 feet away. Bullpen for the C's has been warming up. There's nothing left in the Hawks. They're done. The 0-1 is in the dirt, and the count goes to 1-1. How about this? The first rounder of the Chicago Cubs comes in and walks in the tying run. Boy, the adrenaline must have just been a bit too much. And now you've got Rafael Taplan against the man that has helped the Canadians get to this spot in the first place. A cult figure in this city that's about to etch his name if a base hit finds its way. Fastball outside, and the count goes to 2-1. I don't care where you play. I don't care where you've been or what you do. It is an absolute challenge to pitch in the net when you're on the road. It's a major league environment, I swear to you. 2-1. Lace in the left. 8-7. Bring him around. The throw's going to be off the mark of the sea. We're up by two.
Number 44, Connor Johnson.
6'6" behemoth with an opportunity to put the cherry on an unbelievable Sunday. The pitch from the right-hander is inside. It'll get away. Here comes the run for 30. Scores! Sweeney makes it 10-7 Vancouver. Nine unanswered runs by the Canadian to lead by 3 as the defending Northwest League champions say not tonight.
The Canadians would go on and win that game. They would go on and win that series for their second straight Northwest League championship. Now, really quickly, quick history lesson here. Vancouver Canadians were with the Oakland Athletics for 11 seasons and never once won a Northwest League championship. Twice at short season, they got to the final in 04 and 05, ironically in one of those championship series losing to Boise. But once the Toronto Blue Jays came to town, it was just the perfect storm, wasn't it? Vancouver Canadians, in their first year of that relationship, won a championship, and then would go on to win championships in the second year and third year as well. And then, of course, with Nate Pearson, the Canadians won their fourth championship this decade. That was in 2017. All right, my thanks to everybody for listening. I know we're tucked away on a Sunday morning here on Sportsnet 650, but we do appreciate you listening online as well. If you follow us at Van Canadians, we will definitely have this posted just minutes after this show. Before we wrap up, I also want to congratulate Erin Lepsansky. She's the winner of our Canadians Community Champion this week. And boy, what a story. She is an LPN and works in community nursing in Vancouver. She takes care of those who need extra time and attention to their medical needs and is working especially hard as many patients have been discharged prematurely out of hospital due to the COVID-19 pandemic measures. Now, prior to being a nurse in the community, she worked at RCH, Royal Columbian Hospital. Most of her clients are elderly, and she has to make house calls to keep them as healthy as possible. This, I would imagine, is risky given the risk and stress of COVID-19, but she has been wonderful and a very caring person and goes above and beyond every single day to make sure that her patients feel that love. Many of them don't have extended family who they can visit at this time. And by the way, she does love baseball and traveling in her downtime. So congratulations to Erin Lepsansky. She is the recipient of our Canadians Community Champion this week, and she will receive a 10-game nap pack to watch the Vancouver Canadians whenever we get back onto the field. She will also throw out the first pitch at one of those games, and she will also receive a prize pack from Hayall. My thanks once again for listening. Until we do this again on Sunday at 10 o'clock in the morning, 1 week from now, I'm Rob Fay. Have yourself a wonderful day. You've been listening to Vancouver Canadians This Week on the home of everything Canadians, Sportsnet 650. Good morning, everybody.